Good morning, I'm Jim Packard, sitting in for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Glad to have you along with us today. For the last time as presidents, Bush and Putin met over the weekend to sign the Strategic Framework Declaration. We will be talking about the declaration and overall U.S. and Russian foreign policy relations with David MacDonald, professor and chair of the Department of History at the UW-Madison. David, it's a pleasure to have you back at our microphones again.
Always nice to be here, Jim. Thank you.
What did you take away from the weekend as far as the relationship between the countries now?
I suppose on the face of it, not much change. Even the strategic declaration and the framework, it has certain principles that each side tried to present as a breakthrough. But it's really a document that states an agreement to disagree over certain areas. But on the other hand, compared to 20 years ago, for instance, a polite and strong commitment to bilateral cooperation and consultation is something that we would not have seen. So to that extent, it's a good coda to the career of George Bush and his relations with Russia, and to Vladimir Putin as he gets ready for his new job.
So they have met 28 times since their first meeting in 2001. And the kind of relationship that they have seems to be quite personable and yet leaves room for lots of disagreements over the intentions of the other.
Well, I think that's a good description. I think both sides, for various reasons, have benefited from the obvious personal rapport the two have. I think Bush would still stand by his statement that you can see into his soul and see that he's a trustworthy man. And I think what they've done is established a sort of triage or hierarchy of issues, some on which they cooperate, for instance, dealing with the conflict in Afghanistan, and others on which they disagree but don't see this as a prelude to nuclear Armageddon. So to that extent, and finally that willingly or no, the United States and President Bush have increasingly recognized Putin and the Russian Federation as a real player in a series of global strategic issues.
If you'd like to join this conversation as we talk about foreign policy between the United States and Russia, you can call us in Madison at 263-1890. Otherwise, it's toll-free at 800-642-1234. Those are different numbers than you'd normally use for Kathleen's program. In Madison, again, 263-1890. Otherwise, toll-free at 800-642-1234. And, of course, our email address is talk@wpr.org as we talk with Professor David MacDonald, Chair of the Department of History at the UW-Madison. Much was made over the kind of language that was being haggled about between Secretary of State Condi Rice and Russia's foreign minister over the word assuage.
Oh, I saw that. Yeah, assuaging or easing the Russia's concerns. I think what it was from what little I've read and what I would infer is that the difference between the two is one represents an act of magnanimity and almost condescension on the part of the United States, and the other, connote a real interest in, quote, easing concerns, mm-hmm. and in recognizing that there really are concerns. Assuaging is more you don't agree that there are concerns, but you're willing to make the grand gesture. So, and it's on those sorts of things that diplomatic documents and statements, which are usually negotiated well before their issue, it's on those things that they seem to turn.
Well, let's talk about the United States has suggested, of course, placing this missile defense system in a couple of hot spots as far as Russia is concerned, Croatia, the Ukraine, Georgia, all mentioned as possible sites.
The ones that gave the Russians initial concern were the sighting in the Czech Republic and in Poland. And I think where Ukraine and Georgia and Croatia came up was in connection with the missiles, but also in the case of the latter two, there were strong apprehensions that NATO would go along with the American proposal to invite Ukraine and Georgia to adhere to the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. Croatia received such an invitation this time at the summit in Bucharest, along with Albania. Putin and Ivanov, the Russian foreign minister, both frequently expressed strong disagreement with the idea of admitting Ukraine and Georgia to NATO.
We're talking with David McDonald, and if you'd like to join the conversation, some lines are open. But let's start off with Greg calling from Chicago. And Greg, what's on your mind?
Yeah, I'd just like to know why Russia doesn't see the light about the Iran, the missile sites going up in Poland, Georgia, and all over that area as a defense system, not at them, but at terrorism and tyranny, because Iran has a bunch of weapons depots that you wouldn't believe. I know guys that went in there on recon. Yeah, that's a very serious thing that Bush is doing. It's a good thing. And Russian Putin, he should join in on us and back us.
You're expressing very, very well the American take on this situation. I think that there are two factors that come into play that would make the situation look different from Moscow. And I think one thing we have to do, and we've not done very well, is rather than say they're wrong or they're perverse or that, to recognize that they have their own view of their own interests. And as far as Iran's concerned, I think they feel that they have a good finger on what's going on strategically with Iran. They're involved with supplying technology to a couple of nuclear reactors down there. And I think the Russians would say, we have a historic and a longstanding relationship with Iran. We've got good contacts in their establishment. We can keep a more reliable eye on what's going on there than the Americans. Secondly, with regard to the sighting of the missiles, I agree with you. I don't see rogue actors in the Czech Republic or Poland, or even, well, less the case Georgia. I don't see these missiles falling out of control. But I think what Putin is saying is, we have geostrategic interests in these areas, and you're moving unilaterally without consulting us on these missiles, which could conceivably be targeted at us, is something that we are not willing to accept. That on one level, it's about respect and recognition as an equal, and I think they choose these issues because it's a place where you can get the Americans' attention. It's also a place where you can try and put a wedge between the United States and the other side of the Atlantic in the EU.
Right.
Greg, thanks very much for your call.
All right. Thank you. Thanks, sir.
Thank you.
Appreciate hearing from you. And if you'd like to join in, the number in Madison is 263-1890. Otherwise, it's toll-free at 800-642-1234. Talking with David McDonald about Russian and United States foreign policy relations. David is chair of the Department of History at the UW-Madison. One of the things that was a bit of a surprise to me was the suggestion by President Putin that perhaps a global kind of missile framework, missile defense framework, could be put in place somewhere down the road.
He's been suggesting that. That's been one of his alternatives to the NATO plan or the American plan for stationing rather targeted missiles in allied countries. That from the outset of this discussion, the Russian response was, well, if you're interested in global security and you're really worried about the crescent of crisis, right, from eastern Turkey all the way to I suppose the Pakistani border, wouldn't it make sense to have a multilateral system, and we would be willing to supply technology and sites like Baku in Azerbaijan? Of course, nobody consulted the Azeris, but let's have a system in which we take equal part. And, of course, for all sorts of reasons to do with intelligence and a spontaneous and unwanted technology transfer, among other things, they've not found ready cooperation from the NATO allies. But what it's done, and what you have to do, or what often people do very effectively in these situations, if you create another area of discussion, another alternative, then interlocutors, people in the conversation, are obliged to take it into account. So I think what they're trying to do is just establish an alternative that they can try and coax other powers. And I think they've got an eye on China, they've got an eye on India and Pakistan, in trying to create this multilateral global security system, because ultimately I think that's what they want, mm-hmm. to get away from an idea of what they would consider U.S. hegemony in the world and to create a multipolar global system in which more or less traditional balance of power considerations would come into effect.
President Putin will step down on May 7th and become prime minister. President Bush met his successor, Mr. Medvedev.
Medvedev. Yeah.
And said that he was a smart fellow.
Yeah. He's a. What we don't know a great deal about him. We know that he's from St. Petersburg, which makes him a despair of Moscow intellectuals. He's a part of this. It's an interesting characterization in Russia that during the Soviet period, Leningrad, as it was then called, was seen as sort of vaguely dissenting, alternative, high culture, traditional, and Moscow was the power center. Now, Muscovite writers talk about St. Petersburg as these sort of barbarian provincial oafs who are coming in with their ham-fisted ways. Medvedev is trained as a lawyer, as I recall, was a protege of Putin's, has never held high state office before. He's on a board of directors of a couple of corporations. And he seems smart. We know that he likes Deep Purple, which is a strange choice for somebody who's in his early 40s. I would have associated that with about 10 or 15 years more age. But he likes metal, and he seems smart. And during the campaign for this presidential election, he also held a relatively softer rhetorical line. He talked about his interest in seeing real democracy in Russia. But right now he's a cipher, and I think everybody's thinking of him as a placeholder while Putin moves into the Duma, takes over as prime minister, as leader of United Russia, the political party that he helped put together. And by doing this, it's something actually I predicted on your show about a year and a half ago. By doing this, I think that Putin is guaranteeing or showing that he recognizes constitutional mandates while maintaining whatever countries or coalitions he's developed to keep himself and his supporters in power.
Talking with David MacDonald, and if you'd like to join the conversation, the number in Madison is 263-1890, otherwise toll-free at 800-642-1234. I'm Jim Packard, and you're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Jim Packard in for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Glad to have you along with us today as we talk about Russian and United States relations. This follows the weekend signing of a declaration by President Bush and President Putin at the Black Sea Resort, where the Russian leader has his country home.
Has one of several country homes, yeah, but one in Sochi, which is where the 2014 Winter Olympics will also take place.
He apparently showed President Bush a model of the Olympic setup as he saw it, and pointed out a little boat in the harbor, which he said would be President Bush's boat.
Exactly.
Where he could stay. And in terms of the Olympics, you certainly have problems for China leading into what's going on there. Is that same sort of problem facing the Russians as they look ahead?
It's hard to predict 6 years from now, but right now I don't think so. There's a possibility. I think they will be very vigilant about disturbances in the neighboring region, the north slope of the Caucasus, and the Chechen conflict can always flare up again. It's an incredibly volatile situation, but the peoples of the North Caucasus do not have the same sort of international support that the Dalai Lama has been able to mobilize in opposition to the Chinese government. And so you never know. There's a good possibility for local violence and for terrorist acts, but I don't see it being either an international mobilization, as is occurring in support of Tibetans right now, as we just saw in Paris yesterday, or a situation like 1980 in Moscow, which still rests heavily on the memories of a great many Russians, pro and anti-communist, mm-hmm. that the international boycott following the invasion of Afghanistan was seen as a political and public relations humiliation. I think whoever's planning this Olympics has got that very much on her mind and is going to be doing whatever she can to prevent that.
Talk about Russia and in the years since the 2001 meeting between the two presidents, how has Russia changed? Certainly, it's a lot richer than it was at that time.
It's a lot richer. Patterns of distribution of wealth are still very stratified. Institutionally, it's become more stable. It's become more quote-unquote normal, or at least Russians now pursue, go after their daily bread and pursue their lives in a political and legal landscape that they mostly, that they can rely on as being stable. It's much more centralized than it used to be. Local authorities now are much more accountable to Moscow than they were in 2001 or during the Yeltsin years. And I think Russians feel a stronger and a more evident patriotism. It's, I think what's surprising is the amount of support that the Putin administration enjoys. To some people, it looks like they've become re-authoritarianized, if I can use a very awkward word, that the way that the government has more or less taken over the TV networks, there's a few independent radio stations left, but the electronic media, with the exception of the internet, are pretty much under government control. But at the same time, again, I have to emphasize the amount of support that the Putin administration has enjoyed is quite remarkable. It would be the envy of most Western politicians. And from what we can tell, or what I can tell looking at polls on Russian websites and in Russian institutes, a lot of this support is genuine, that he is associated with a process not only of economic enrichment and growth, but of Russia's reemergence as what they would call a great Russia, as an international power to be reckoned with, not as the international laughingstock or derelict that many Russians felt the country had become during the 1990s.
Mm-hmm. When you mentioned the invasion of Afghanistan, and was there some agreement reached as far as Afghanistan between Presidents Putin and Bush?
Yeah, as I recall, after 9/11 and in the run-up to the operations against the Taliban and al-Qaeda in Afghanistan, certain Central Asian republics had allowed the Americans to use Air Force bases, old Soviet bases, as staging points for taking troops and supplies in. Uzbekistan has since withdrawn that after a political controversy over the repression of a popular disturbance. But Russia, the Russian Federation, did agree to continue to provide logistical support to American and NATO forces in Afghanistan.
And the president, of course, in his meetings with some of the NATO countries, was looking for additional manpower to go in and fight in Afghanistan.
That's been a lingering controversy that started about 8 to 10 months ago. There's a feeling among some of the NATO powers, my home country, Canada, feels that the Canadian Army is being asked to put its troops in positions of great danger, especially in the southeast of Kandahar. And a lot of other NATO allies are sticking with much less dangerous support duties up around Kabul, where it's not secure, but there's certainly a lot less danger of attack. I think the feeling is the United States, Great Britain, and Canada are carrying more load than they should in the combat operations, and whereas the other countries will plead, well, we're giving lots of economic support. I believe the Netherlands has troops in active roles, but Germany has its own domestic problems about the use of troops abroad, mm-hmm. Understandably so. So that's been an ongoing management problem. problem really since Secretary of Defense Gates, probably speaking from the heart, but not to ultimate diplomatic effect, complained politely that probably some of the troops, including Canadian troops, weren't as well trained in the conduct of the type of warfare they had to be prosecuting. They weren't well enough trained to be as effective as the Americans. And this led to there's pressure in Canada, less so in Britain, to either find a proper term or a date certain when they can withdraw, or to get more support from other NATO members.
David McDonald is our guest, and let's go back to the phones to Joe in Rhinelander. Hi, Joe. What's on your mind?
Good morning, gentlemen.
Mm-hmm.
I would like to know if Mr. Putin has perhaps considered playing the energy card, which it would seem that he holds, in that I believe Russia is sitting on probably the world's largest reserves of oil and gas, and unlike the old Frederick Forsyth novels where Russia was always depicted as having a shortage of oil and was always scheming to get more, it would seem that they might even have a surplus of energy, and we in the West are in desperate need of oil, and it would seem that Russia could exploit this in some manner. I wonder if the professor could comment on the energy picture in the Russian Federation, and I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you for a good program.
Thanks, Joe.
Well, thank you, Joe. That's a very good question, because that you've put your finger on a growing apprehension, especially among Europeans, that you're quite right. Russia has huge proven reserves of oil and natural gas, and in contrast to the Frederick Forsyth days, when they knew they had these resources. Now they've got the technology and the means by which to extract them and to move them, to pipe them. And one of the elements in the growing rapprochement between Europe and Russia is the expansion of a network of pipelines for gas and oil that really date back to Soviet times. But what the apprehension is... The Europeans are really caught in a cleft stick, because the other potential supplier is the Persian Gulf nations and Persian Gulf states. And the Europeans found out in the early 1970s that these states are willing to use the oil, willing to turn off the tap if they don't agree with your foreign policy, right after the Yom Kippur War in 73. This is the first oil embargo. Now, Russia, on the one, the Russian representatives are doing a very good job of selling the idea of Russia as an energy partner, as a supplier, and the like. But a great many Europeans have watched what has happened between Russia and Ukraine 2 years ago, Russia and Georgia at a couple of junctures over the last two winters, where on one level, I suppose legitimately, Russian governments or Gazprom, the mega corporation that controls a lot of Russia's petroleum resources, they will say that people aren't paying their bills and they turn off the tap, right? But it often seems to coincide with matters of political pressure. A writer for The Economist, a man named Edward Lucas, who has just published a book that I don't agree with a great deal, but who represents a strong vein of European opinion, has also noted that Europe's growing dependence on Russian oil makes it vulnerable to the political caprices of a regime that is becoming increasingly interested in throwing around its own weight. And one example that everybody points to is the fact that Russia is avoiding Poland. They're building the pipeline on to Europe on the floor of the Baltic Sea, and they're obviating Poland, which is seen as an anti-Polish move on the face of it. So, yeah, the Well, our shared dependence on hydrocarbon fuels is creating all sorts of points of political entree for the Russian Federation. And I should also note, China and Japan find themselves in the same position in the Far East. Both of them are competing with one another to get privileged access to petroleum reserves they need from Russia as well.
Let's go to the phones to William in Middleton. Hello, William.
Oh, yes. There was a book that should be read by every Russian and every American, especially if they're involved in foreign policies, written by a professor, University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee, deceased now, James A. Brundage, B-R-U-N-D-A-G-E, The Chronicle of Henry of Livonia, a translation translated from Latin, with introduction and notes. And in that book, and also there is a good blog, F-I-N-N-I-C-S and a number 7, Phoenix 7, just Google it. You'll find a map. It shows how the tribes, what tribes existed in northern Russia, in Poland, Livonia, Estonia, etc., around the time of Henry, the great king of France, what's his name? About the year 700, etc. In other words, when we discuss history with Russia and Russia discusses with us, we, the politicians, should make aware to them that they have taken many lands, origins, areas away from peoples, indigenous people, just like we now say to the Chinese that you have invaded, taken indigenous people's lands away in Tibet. And that is never brought up. And I would think that that would help both American politicians and the Russian people to understand our long ancient origins and maybe help us calm us all down a little bit.
I take your point. I think the Livonians were the Livonian Order is a crusading order of German-speaking knights from the northern part of what's present-day Germany, and they really don't start showing up in the area you're talking about until the 12th and 13th centuries. But in terms of is this a multinational order that was based on a certain population that absorbed other populations, it's a point of some curiosity to me as a historian of Russia and to many of my colleagues that we look at that as somehow unique and somehow a noteworthy aspect of Russian history that we should keep an eye on. And by way of example, we don't, unless we're Irish, make that point about the English, who took over the free country of my ancestors, the Scots, in either 1603 or 1707. And as North Americans, we should probably be a bit careful of talking about the seizure of territories and populations inhabited by prior denizens. I'm sure there's lots of First Nations listeners in the LCO or Lac de Flambeau and the area who would say, well, the Russians weren't the only people that did this. It's unfortunately, it's almost a way of the world, these types of imperial expansion. And as far as the Livonian Knights are concerned, if you were a Russian ruler at that time, the Mongols have just destroyed a lot of princely families, and you're watching all these foreign-speaking Christians, well, different type of Christians, Catholics, coming in to lead a crusade against you. So, that's why we have history, is to try and get at all sides of the story. But I agree with you. Your basic point, I agree with very strongly, is that I think it's not that history teaches us lessons, it's that history shows us how people come to take the perspective they do, to look at the world in the way they do, based on their understanding of their own community's experience. And I think that a great deal of foreign policy fails to take that into account, or takes it into account in superficial ways, and tends to rely on an understanding of systems and relationships that often neglects the historical component.
Are you familiar with the blog that he referred to?
No, I'm not. Mm-hmm. No, but I'll look at it now.
All right. Thanks very much for the call. Appreciate that. Our lines are open if you have a question or a comment that you would like to make about foreign policy between the United States and Russia. The number in Madison is 263-1890, otherwise toll-free at 800-642-1234. Our email address, talk@wpr.org, as we talk with David McDonald, who's the chair of the History Department at the University of Wisconsin and is also an expert on Russian history, which we're referring to today. The president apparently did some dancing with a Russian folk troupe, and Putin described Bush as a brilliant dancer or something akin to that.
Yes, I would have paid good rubles and euros to witness that Terpsichorean display.
Let's talk about the efforts that will be made now to go ahead with some sort of diplomatic entree to continue the process that was that we saw last weekend.
Well, it's going to be interesting to watch because there are two wild cards, one more obvious than the other. First, you're going to have a change of administration one way or the other in this country. And all the candidates, including Senator McCain on the Republican side, have done what they can to distance themselves to greater or lesser extent from what they've seen as the foreign policy of the Bush administration. What also is going to change is something you alluded to earlier, is that the bilateral relations between the Russian Federation and the United States have rested in large part on the anchor of trust, mutual trust and respect that Putin and Bush have been able to construct. You saw something similar, but in a much different context, when Bush succeeded Clinton in the relationship with Tony Blair in Great Britain. The second wild card, again the less obvious one, is the fact that in becoming prime minister, Putin is entering into a branch of government, the legislative branch, which does not have foreign political prerogative. Obviously, there are networks and there are factions through which he can operate, in whom he's installed in power, and through which he can still take a hand in foreign relations. But new situations are by their very nature unpredictable. We don't know what Medvedev's going to be like. We don't know. We know that there's a constellation of factions grouped around the Kremlin troughs who each have different long-term policy goals that might mandate different relationships with NATO and with the United States. We have other wild cards. Ukraine. Ukraine is going through its own uneasy process of accommodating new institutions. It's still working through the aftermath of the Orange Revolution of 2004. The Caucasus, as always, unstable. We look south of the Caucasus. Iraq and the Kurdish Aglaé on the northern part of Iraq, Iran, Syria, Turkey. All of these things are potentially explosive elements that could affect the relationship. And finally, again, the 800-pound gorilla in the room is China, mm-hmm. especially this whole run-up to the Olympics and the aftermath creates interesting opportunities and possibilities and challenges for both Russian and American leaders. So what's interesting about this relationship, again, because we tend to think of it as a successor to the old Cold War relationship, is the world it's taking place in now is it's not more complex. It's just that it's impossible to dominate or have a bilateral negotiation to resolve problems or let them go in the way that you used to be able to do.
Our guest is David McDonald. We'll take more of your calls in just a moment here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Jim Packard, sitting in for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Glad to have you along with us today as we talk about Russian and United States foreign policy. And if you'd like to join in, there is a line open in Madison at 263-1890. Otherwise, toll free at 800-642-1234. David, let's see what's on the mind of more of our listeners. We'll go to Dan in White Lake next. Hi, Dan.
Good morning. I have a question. Since we keep offering membership in NATO to odds and ends of countries, and always conditionally, including Georgia, which, as I recall, is north and east of Turkey and puts it in the Asian landmass, what's the downside risk of offering membership in NATO to Russia, other than a lot of Europeans, particularly the Finns, might not dig it? Are they a camel we'd rather have in the tent peeing out than vice versa? And I'll listen off the air.
It's a good question, but what's also interesting is that since the 1980s, Europe seems to stretch out to Kazakhstan, that if you look at membership in the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe. And I think you put your finger on precisely there's one of two problems here. One is, what is NATO's strategic purpose? This was an alliance that was meant to be a shield against apprehended Soviet expansion out of Eastern Europe in the first years of the Cold War. It also, interestingly and in a funny way, ironically, served as the shield under which the European community, the EC, and finally the European Union was able to congeal. But the other problem with NATO is it seems to have become sort of diffuse in terms of what its strategic raison d'etre is, why it exists. And by inviting in Georgia, by talking about inviting in Georgia, Ukraine, and not inviting Russia, I think this is where you start getting Muscovite suspicions about NATO's intention, about the intentions of international or of these defensive missile systems and the like. On the other hand, Russia does enjoy a mandated partnership with NATO. It's a Russian representative can sit with the consults with the directing strategic group for NATO. But I think you're right. The fact that Russia isn't invited is something that all NATO members, including the United States, agree on.
Bob in Darlington, did you have something more to add to that about Russia in NATO?
Yeah, that was my question, although I would like to ask David about when this new leader will step in to assist Putin or take over for him, or if they will join together and work together, or how the structure of these two fellows will actually transpire.
Sure. Just to complete my earlier thoughts too, Bob, the biggest and thinking of the caller from White Lake whose name I forget and I apologize, I suppose the biggest thing, and I'm putting myself in the place of an American strategic policymaker, is the thing with an alliance, and NATO is supposedly still an alliance, is that you're supposed to be able to trust your allies, and you're all supposed to agree on even diffuse strategic goals, and you're supposed to guarantee your allies' interests. And I don't think there are many NATO powers, let alone the United States, who want to commit themselves to a continuing defense of Russian interests. There are enough areas of conflict beyond the old Cold War problems that just doesn't make sense to have them in the alliance. But it also says something. I think the United States government has its hands full dealing with France, dealing with the Turks right now, the Turks, the Greeks, the and Eastern Mediterranean issues. Now, on Putin and Medvedev, right now, and if you watch the campaign, it was going back to the parliamentary elections in December. To answer your first question first, on May the 7th, The day before Victory Day, Medvedev will be inaugurated as the new president of the Russian Federation. And according to the Speaker of the Duma, on May the 8th, the quote-unquote ideal candidate, Vladimir Putin, will find himself elected as prime minister, appointed prime minister, as the head of the largest party in the Duma. Their relationship, when you saw them on campaign, there was a little bit of Big Brother, Little Brother, or Mini-Me going on. Medvedev is much slighter of stature than Putin. He's not a devotee of judo or martial arts. This is how Putin keeps himself in fighting trim. He's not a KGB. He's not a KGB or FSB type. He's out of a different sphere. I think, at least for the first 18 months, 2 years, there will be Putin will look like the sage mentor to a neophyte president who's finding his way. But on the other hand, Medvedev signals to a lot of Russians the possibility of a stable, institutionalized, forward-looking country. He's young, but for the near future, I wouldn't expect big changes.
Bob, thank you very much for the call. We appreciate hearing from you. And let's go to Dan in Eau Claire next. Dan, what's on your mind today?
Good morning, gentlemen. I enjoy your program. I have to admit that the political leverage aspect of Russia's rich petroleum reserves is an aspect of that landscape that I've never really given any thought to whatsoever. And it certainly does have the tendency to, change things dramatically in a shift of leverage towards them over the next several years. And I guess my question is, how long can we continue to ignore our own fossil reserves at the peril of, I guess, maximizing their legitimacy and their political leverage because of theirs? Just a comment. I'll take your thoughts off the air.
No, it's a very good question. I suppose it's not my area, but since I'm here and I've got the microphone, the three things I would tell you are because a lot of people are thinking of Prudhoe Bay and the North Shore, the North Slope in Alaska. The tar sands in situated around Fort McMurray, Alberta, are huge. Potential supplier for American energy needs, and the province of Alberta is becoming very rich out of this fact. What's also interesting, though, and it's starting to arouse concern among even Americans, is there's a fair amount of environmental devastation that's taking place as a consequence. And in spite of the fact that the Canadian government is much more strict in its environmental regulations, they're seeing collateral damage, if I can borrow a term from another arena, that is really producing unforeseen damage to the environment around Fort McMurray, which is about 180 miles northeast of Edmonton. But the second thing is the question that a lot of people ask, I think fairly, is do we want to sacrifice the autonomy that we usually expect of a sovereign country by sustaining what the president himself has referred to as an addiction to oil? And Americans have to start asking themselves, in addition to looking at other fossil fuels, revisiting nuclear, subsidizing alternative technologies, whether it's solar, wind, tides. But the tough thing in a society like ours is getting people to make short-term sacrifice for long-term goals in the absence of a palpable danger. But there's no question the petroleum card has inflected our relationships with certain Middle Eastern powers and has a very good chance of doing so with the Russian Federation in the future.
Thank you, Dan. Appreciate your call, and let's go to Al in Bayfield, and should you choose to join us, the number in Madison is 263-1890, or toll-free at 800-642-1234 to talk with David McDonald, the chair of the History Department at the UW-Madison. Go ahead, Al.
Yeah,
thanks.
Good morning. I want to bring this back to the political race in America. Interesting column today in the Washington Post, and see how your guest feels about this. With this increasing focus on Russia and the relationships and what may unfold in the future, does that make it more likely for John McCain to consider Condoleezza Rice as a VP
running mate because of her strong background in Russian history, culture, and the whole thing?
As I recall, it's a good question, and I know that Secretary Rice's name has started surfacing all over the place. I still think she's going to hold out to be Roger Goodell's successor in the NFL, but I'm not a commentator on American politics, but it seems to me that you do not appoint a vice president for their foreign policy expertise, that Americans tend to vote domestic issues, and especially at a time when Russia's really have disappeared from the American radar screen, except at instances like the Putin-Bush meetings, that you see very little coverage of Russia compared with what was the case in the 90s and the 80s. It's not a huge strategic concern in the way that, again, China is, or the unraveling situation in Pakistan, Afghanistan, the problem of Iran. That one of the interesting things to watch as a historian is to see how slow people can be to reconceptualize the strategic the playing field that they find themselves on, and so. I'm sure Secretary Rice would make a good vice president. She has a pretty good. She's not a historian. She's a political scientist, and has a good working relationship with her Russian counterparts. But my hunch is McCain's advisors would want somebody who could get them votes in Ohio and Pennsylvania.
Mm-hmm. The last time that Russia and the United States relations surfaced was actually beneath the surface when Russia made claim on all of the jewels beneath the sea between Russia and Alaska.
Actually, that was a Canadian story, too.
Because
that's land that the Canadians claim as well. And that's what's interesting, again, watching it as somebody who's vaguely trained in the area, is as opposed to the way the media tend to interpret things for us, is the various levels on which the game is played, right? And that's one thing that is very different than during the Cold War. During the Cold War, everything was sort of a symptom or a move in one integrated game, whereas now you can get this claiming the continental shelf of the northern shore of North America as being part of Russia's territory. And There's a bit of blethering about it, but it doesn't turn into a big thing, right? It's flyovers and violations of airspace. Mm-hmm. There are all sorts of things that are happening all the time. Russia's relationship with Iran, as opposed to that between Iran and the United States of America, that in the old days, these could have all been potential flashpoints. Now it's just different arenas in which you're vying for advantage or preeminence, that you want it in that area, but it doesn't really affect the other areas. So the complexity of the relationship now is fascinating from that point of view.
And Al, just one thing I noticed, that John McCain said that he was not aware and did not hear or didn't see the efforts to try to bring Condi to his attention as a candidate. And I took that as a sort of dismissive to the idea. And if you'd like to join in, the number in Madison, 263-1890. Otherwise, it's toll-free at 800-642-1234 as we talk with David McDonald, who is a professor of history and chair of the Department of History at the UW-Madison. I noticed that Mr. Putin was asked whether relations were better or worse after their roughly parallel term in office, and he said at least a repeat of the Cuban Missile Crisis was now impossible.
Yeah, well, it's true. I think that's a statement that illustrates better than I was able to my attempt to illustrate or to show just how much more sophisticated and complex this relationship has become, and how much more strategically heterogeneous the world has become, right? That it used to be we thought of the world as these fronts, right? These walls, that behind one of which stood the Soviet Union, behind the other stood the United States, mm-hmm. Vietnam, and the whole idea of the domino theory, the Angolan civil war, the Afghan invasion. Everywhere you looked, there were these signs of bilateral confrontation. Or that's how we looked at it. It was always much more complex. But now that there, I can't think of a single issue that could possibly could probably arise that would spark a bilateral conflagration, such as the Cuban Missile. Neither side has that much control anymore over their strategic environment.
And to Jean in Ashland. Jean, what's on your mind this morning?
Hi. As a Canadian, your guest must know all about what's been going on in the Mackenzie River Delta, Richards Island there. The experimental drilling is supposed to be about six different international drilling companies that have been tuning up their methods of drilling for switching over from oil to methane gas hydrates, which is supposed to be many, just enormous deposits all over the world, and we're not drilling for them. The oil companies are the ones who would naturally be drilling for them. They're training to reach these different kinds of deposits, different levels of deposits. But they're all over, and it's supposed to be enough to last 170,000 years.
David, your familiarity with that?
Very little, although the big thing in any of these technology switchovers, even if you're using combustion, is byproducts, but also adapting how many millions of engines and machines and that to a new fuel. But that's one good example of the types of alternatives that we really have to explore. Whether it's whatever one believes of global warming, if nothing else, again, to relieve our awkward dependence on a bunch of suppliers over whom we have relatively little control, ask Hugo Chavez.
David, thank you so much for spending the hour with us. It's flown by, and we've enjoyed it.
Always enjoy it myself.
Thank you very much. David MacDonald is a professor of history, chair of the Department of History at the UW-Madison, as we talked about Presidents Bush and Putin meeting over the weekend to sign the Strategic Framework Declaration. And if you'd like a CD of the program, it's available through the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Our thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the program, to Carmen Jackson for on-air production. I'm Jim Packard, and you're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.